Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. This is a fascinating time in American politics. The presidential race is in full swing and full of surprises. There's fierce competition for both the Democratic and Republican nominations for president. Donald Trump is the surprise leader among Republicans. Senator Bernie Sanders is surprisingly popular among Democrats and actually leading Hillary Clinton in early voting states. Both parties recently held lively candidate debates. Meanwhile, Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives are in chaos. The Speaker of the House is resigning, and it's not clear anyone in the Republican caucus can get the votes to take his place. Here to help us understand what's happening and what it means to us is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. He also writes a weekly op-ed column for the Washington Post. Previously, he was executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, The LA Times, and many other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
I can't wait for this conversation. There's just so much happening politically. Let's start with...
There is, yes.
Yes. Let's start with the Democratic debate that just happened this week, where the candidates were... They are vying for the presidential nomination in the Democratic Party. What did you think of the debate?
Well, I thought it was several things. First of all, in the broadest sense, I think it made clear two things about the Democratic Party. One, that the party as a whole has moved to the left largely in response to the continuing deformation of American capitalism, which is not going very well for the vast majority of Americans, and the party is reacting and moving further to the left than it has been, much as it did, say, during the New Deal era, when capitalism was also being suffering its periodic ailments and inflicting them on the majority of American people. So that's pretty clear. And then the other thing is simply again confirming what we already know, that the gap between the Democrats and the Republicans has to be measured in light years. They don't remotely even discuss the same topics. The Democrats, I think, have the empirical advantage of discussing topics that are real rather than imagined. The Republicans discuss topics like the immigrant crime wave when it's quite clear there is no immigrant crime wave. I think it's reflective of a general movement in the Democratic Party. And one of the ways that's visible to discuss something that is actually not the media's radar scan most of the time is the real shift in the kind of studies being released by think tanks, which really sort of represent the center of the Democratic Party, things like the Center for American Progress, which was set up by people coming out of the Clinton presidency, and the Roosevelt Institute. Over the past year, both of them have increasingly been releasing studies about financial reform, boosting workers' rights, clearly moving left. I take that as significant both in itself and partly because there are a lot of people working in these places who would no doubt be appointees, not just in a Bernie Sanders administration, but in a Hillary Clinton administration. And we see it in things like some of the writing, both for the Center for American Progress and elsewhere, that Larry Summers, who was the Treasury Secretary for Bill Clinton at a time of financial deregulation, and then an economic advisor to Barack Obama, writing about the importance of boosting worker power, things like that, which, you know, you never would have heard out of people like Larry Summers 5-6 years ago. So, I mean, I think there's a large move on the part of the Democratic Party, both the center of the party, which Hillary Clinton pretty much personifies, and certainly the left of the party, which Bernie Sanders has, I think to everyone's surprise, including his own, has come to become the champion of, and then pushing ideas that have, you know, 5-6 years ago, 7-8 years ago, were beyond the pale for many Democrats, and clearly are not now.
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, probably the conditions in the country, even though, you know, we had the big dive there in 2008 and the Great Recession, it's been kind of a slow recovery, with most of the gains going to the upper income earners, leaving out, you know, the other 90%. I think that particular punch, and combined with the past really 30 years of political decisions and policies being made that tend to favor the upper wealthy people, is really all those chickens are coming home to roost. People are unhappy, and they don't feel a big difference, big improvement in their own lives. So I think maybe that's where this move to the left is coming from. You're talking about among Democrats, and you're right. Bernie Sanders is the champion of the left now. He's speaking to huge crowds across the country, building a big base of support. What do you think it is that Bernie is saying or doing that's resonating with people?
Well, first of all, he has one thing in common with Donald Trump, and that is they are both telling very clear stories. Trump's is fictitious, Bernie's is not, but they're both telling stories that have, as it were, good guys and bad guys. Trump's bad guys are immigrants, among others. Bernie's bad guys are the Wall Street financiers who have cooked the system, not just the economic system, but the political system, entirely to their own advantage, to the detriment of everyone else. But I think it's that kind of storytelling that resonates. And then Bernie has, you know, kind of an unquestionable authenticity, which also comes across well. Funny, I had an email exchange today with an editor, a friend of mine who's an editor of a very prominent liberal magazine, and this person was talking about, you know, does it really help Bernie to be citing, you know, places like Denmark as an example? And I said, in and of itself, probably not. But it is part of the authenticity package. I mean, you know, Bernie doesn't shy, and in fact, loudly honks his democratic socialism and his appreciation of what the social democratic nations, in particular of Northern Europe, have been able to accomplish. So, you know, I mean, that, you know, you don't run openly as a socialist, to put it mildly, speaking as one myself. You know, you cannot be accused of tailoring your remarks to the powerful or specific audiences, or trying to gloss over aspects of who you are. So he gets a lot of points, I think, which really helps, given the understandably cynical or skeptical nature of most Americans towards elected officials. That gains him authenticity points. But as in this email exchange, I was saying, you know, someone's going to do a doctoral dissertation, you know, some years hence, on, you know, authenticity in the 2016 presidential contest, and, you know, what were the limits of authenticity? How far could you go with it before it started hurting you? And that's certainly a question for Bernie Sanders, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's great. I'm glad you mentioned about him not shying away from being a democratic socialist. I mean, he's wearing it as a badge of honor. It is his really guiding political philosophy. It's what he's been talking about the entire time he's been in the political life, starting as mayor in Burlington and moving up in Vermont there. It seems like now there is a match between his political philosophy and the moment of America, where people are feeling like, well, maybe democratic socialism isn't so bad. And I thought when Anderson Cooper kind of spit at him about, well, you're a democratic socialist, so how do you expect to win? And Bernie gave such a spirited defense of, he said, well, I'll just explain what democratic socialism is. And then he described what it was. It's like it's a program that, you know, certainly any Democrat would be happy to support. So it was fascinating to see that political philosophy. How would you describe democratic socialism? And what do you think, you know, Bernie as a representative of democratic socialist politics in America?
Well, I mean, this is new terrain, and as far as your second question about representing democratic socialist politics in America, because while America has had brilliant democratic socialist leaders, from Gene Debs to Norman Thomas to Michael Harrington, and some brilliant leaders who were democratic socialists, so that was not their primary identity, foremost of whom was Martin Luther King, none of them have ever performed on the electoral stage on the scale that Bernie Sanders is doing right now. What Bernie Sanders is talking about is the kind of social democratic politics that have taken root, in particular, in Scandinavia and Germany, Like the United States, this takes as its premise a democratic republican elected form of government. It presumes that while some things like health care are best viewed as rights that simply, you know, go with your being a citizen of the country, and are best handled, therefore, at least the payment side of that is best handled by the state, that you still retain a vibrant private sector. Now, I would argue, and I do so actually in my column in today's Washington Post, that one of the great ironies of the modern world is that some of the most successful capitalist economies are in those Scandinavian and German countries by virtue of the social democratic politics there. I'll give you, you know, a big for instance as regards Germany in particular. I think Germany, it can safely be said, has the most successful economy of any advanced capitalist nation over the last decade. One reason that is the case is that while in the United States, under prodding from Wall Street and finance, a huge number of, let's say, small and middle-sized manufacturing companies have gone out of business because Wall Street said, look, you know, to the big companies, you can get this cheaper if it's made in China or somewhere else. Just close, you know, forget about patronizing American businesses and so on. By virtue of giving workers more power in the social democratic countries, they have been able to basically keep their small and middle-sized businesses flourishing, reduce the share of offshoring of industry, that sort of thing. And so I think the key distinction I would make is that there is a deeper belief that people's human rights include economic rights in the social democratic countries, and Bernie Sanders certainly exemplifies that and speaks for it. And there is a kind of greater sense that capitalism needs a countervailing power in giving workers power, giving workers more power than they have here, be it through making it easier for them to form unions, or in Germany, dividing the boards of directors of corporations evenly between worker representatives and management representatives, that sort of thing. And also a crucial point is the relative size and therefore the clout of the financial sector in those countries is far less than it is here and in Britain, which are the two major countries most dominated by Wall Street here and what's called the city. in London by the financial sector. So those are real differences. But it's important to point out, and this is again something I talk about in my Washington Post column today, that there are some significant overlaps and then some significant differences between this tradition and the American progressive tradition. But there are certainly areas of overlap.
Right, and that's a wonderful description there of democratic socialism, kind of what it is and how it's working applied in whole countries, Scandinavia and Germany. And it really was fascinating to see that moment on the stage between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton when they were talking about their political philosophies. And Bernie definitely gave a vigorous explanation and touting the democratic socialism, what it meant, why he believed in it, why we need it now. And Hillary saying, well, I'm a capitalist and we need to help save capitalism from itself periodically, and now is one of those times. So how would you, how do you see that difference of Hillary as kind of representing a progressive who is a capitalist who wants to rein in capitalism, and Bernie, who's a democratic socialist?
Well, I think in the American political dynamic, we more often find a symbiotic relationship between those two traditions than we find an opposed one, which I'll explain in a minute. But just dealing with, like, Hillary's perspective, let's call it the conventional American progressive perspective, it's less inclined to see certain things as economic rights. So Bernie says there should be, as there is, let's say, in most European countries, an economic right to go to college. And as a student, that's not your financial responsibility, just as we say that is the case from K through 12 at public education. Hillary says, well, I think we should more or less make this the case for students who have trouble paying the bill, for wealthy students, not so much. So, you know, I'll go 70% of the way, but not the whole way. So, you know, I mean, I think around this question of economic rights, and whether they apply universally or not is a major distinction. But all of that said, I think there are significant areas of overlap. And I think, you know, a crucial point I want to make is this. Bernie says, well, in order to get my program realized, you know, we need effectively a revolution, a mass mobilization, demanding economic justice and these kinds of policies. What I would say is we need that just to get Hillary's program. And, you know, the reason I say that is this is how American history works. In the 1930s, you have a liberal president, Franklin Roosevelt, and a relatively liberal Congress, but you have major street heat. You have general strikes throughout 1934 in major American cities. You have all kinds of things, actually the specter of Huey Long, coming along and really pressuring the government and Roosevelt to the left in 1935, so they enact Social Security and they enact the National Labor Relations Act, effectively legalizing collective bargaining for most private sector workers. Really, the two key measures of the New Deal, and you need, you know, the president who classically Roosevelt said, you know, I want to save capitalism from itself. And you need radicals in the streets. Same thing in the 1960s when we get the civil rights laws and Medicare and a host of other progressive reforms. You have a liberal president, Lyndon Johnson, a liberal Congress, and you have massive civil rights demonstrations and all of this. So, you know, I mean, the fact is, almost as important, or as important, I should say, as Bernie Sanders' candidacy, is the movement that is, you know, that it has called into being, tapping a really deep sense of economic injustice and what we need to do about it in the United States. And, you know, what I have to keep my fingers crossed on is that movement has got to be there if the Democrat, well, it's got to be there in any case. But if, let's say, Bernie, which I think is a bit of a stretch, or Hillary Clinton, which is less of a stretch, becomes president and takes office in 2017, she needs that movement to build there to get all kinds of progressive changes that don't go as far as Bernie would want, but which would be a significant improvement over what we have now and in any number of areas, paid sick leave, minimum wage, that whole economic justice movement needs to expand and be infused by all the energy that we currently are seeing in among Bernie Sanders supporters.
That's so true, and I think, you know, you look back at when we elected Obama president in 2008, and such a sense of movement and demand for change there. And I think it was riding that wave President Obama could get the health care bill passed that he did. And seems like a lot of people kind of went home and left the rest to him, and it didn't seem to be a lot much good that happened after that. But it was.
And that, I would say, was one of the chief strategic mistakes of the Obama presidency, was it had mobilized all these folks and then kind of let it slide. I would say the Sanders mobilization, if we can call it that, is a little more clearly ideologically defined than Obama's was, and Sanders himself will obviously want to, you know, keep it going. I mean, there's a real question.
Mm-hmm.
I've had, you know, a long discussions on this with Danny Cantor, who was the founder of the Working Families Party in New York and now nationally. Dan had worked on both Jesse Jackson presidential campaigns in the 1980s, and one thing he concluded, and I think not wrongly, was that, you know, to build an ongoing movement, there are a lot better ways to do it than, you know, coming out of a political campaign as such. That was not really where the street heat came from in either the 30s or the 60s. Those weren't Roosevelt volunteers or Kennedy Johnson volunteers. It was a different group of folks and more, oddly perhaps even less electorally inclined, but having greater effect on public policy. Bernie's legions or Bernie's brigades or whatever we want to call them may break that pattern a little, just because I think there's a much clearer electoral, ideological, programmatic definition to who these folks are. But it still will be a challenge. I mean, Howard Dean, Democracy for America, sort of came out of his campaign, which has done some good stuff. But I don't think anyone, including themselves, would argue that they're, you know, a really significant transformative force in American politics. So it's tricky to translate one's energy from, you know, a campaign into some kind of movement. But if there's any campaign that I think may have a shot at doing that, it's Bernie's.
Right, in part because Bernie is self-consciously talking about needing a movement of people to challenge
exactly.
The influence of money and the status quo. And yeah, I think having that awareness about it is really helpful. So it's really interesting to me, you know, reading the recent fundraising reports that Bernie raised almost as much money as Hillary. I think it was $26 million to Hillary's $28 million. And he's leading in the polls in the early states of Iowa and New Hampshire. Do you think he could actually win the Democratic nomination? And if he does he have a shot at winning the presidency?
I think it's a bit of a stretch. I think he will be doing. I think if his polling, if anything, will be higher after the debate, but I think Hillary's polling will probably also be higher after the debate. And I think it's a stretch, but it's not unthinkable as far as the nomination. As far as the actual November election, that's a tougher nut to crack. And I think we're Bernie, through some set of circumstances I consider improbable, to win the Democratic nomination, I think we would probably see an immediate independent candidacy as well from someone like Michael Bloomberg, who would say, Christ, the Republicans have nominated, you know, this right-wing whatever, and the Democrats have nominated a socialist. And, you know, there's got to be some representative for people who are socially liberal and economically not that liberal, and it's got to be someone who can self-fund because there's no time to put, you know, to raise money for this. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a Michael Bloomberg run as a an independent alternative in that case. That might split, you know, the non-Bernie vote and help help elect Bernie. But this, you know, I you know, you wouldn't bet your kid's college tuition on this stuff. I think it's a stretch, but sort of, you know, the thrust of what I've been arguing up to now is that the campaign, and if the Bernie supporters actually can get themselves together, can be a real force to keep moving the Democratic Party and the nation to the left. I mean, you know, I mean, just look at what both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie have accomplished so far in terms of, you know, helping change what the Democrats have been saying. But, you know, look, so has the Fight for 15 campaign, mm-hmm. which has, you know, led to minimum wage increases in a number of cities and states, and which has really changed a lot of the economic discussion on the progressive side of the spectrum. And you know, let's say you combine the Fight for 15 with the Sanders folks, with the Black Lives Matter folks, with the immigrant rights activists, you got a hell of a, you know, you got a significant group of people, and if they can, you know, sort of come together, that would be a huge force for progressive change in America. And if that ends up being the signal contribution of Bernie Sanders to American politics, whether or not he's elected president, that's a huge contribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's that force, no matter who's in, that's going to be pushing to get some of the policies in that we need to really help the country. So, you know, part of me wishes Bernie would get the nomination, and if Trump stayed in, it would be one of the great all-time debates to have Bernie Sanders debating Donald Trump. I mean, I want to be there for that debate.
Yeah, we all do. Believe me, we all do.
maybe no matter what happens with the nominations, we can ask those candidates to debate, I think. It's interesting, you know, during your last appearance on this show, we talked about the need to create an economy that works for all of us with broadly shared prosperity. How do you rate Hillary and Bernie on their ability to deliver on shared prosperity?
Well, I mean, a lot of this goes to what we've just been talking about, which mm-hmm. is, I mean, how would you have rated Franklin Roosevelt on his ability to do this stuff if there hadn't have been the general strikes and the militants reacting to the disaster of the Great Depression? I mean, this is going to be a question. I mean, okay, you would have to push Bernie obviously far less than you would have to push Hillary, but you still have to push, and that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's something called the United States Congress. One of the more instructive political science lessons of the last few years is Barack Obama is now testing how much can a president do absent a Congress that, you know, either wants to do it or, in this case, is functioning at all.
Because
we're absent that as well. I mean, one reason Bernie rightly talks about the need for, you know, this movement to be there is you really have to at some point have Congress. I mean, what's going on right now, this is sort of like water finding a way to flow downhill, is you're getting a lot of progressive change at the level of cities, which are the most distinctly liberal part of the American political spectrum. And that's a relatively new development. Cities have never necessarily been so uniformly progressive relative to the rest of the country, I think, ever. But it is the case that they are now, and you're beginning, you're seeing all of these, you know, sick day things and minimum wage hikes and progressive environmental ordinances adopted at the city level. Some in states, but at the moment there are only 7 states out of the 50 that have both a Democratic governor and Democrats in control of both houses of the legislature. And of those 7 states, they're all small except for the biggest one, which is California, which continues to adopt pretty remarkable legislative reform. So, what can Bernie or Hillary do as president? There's no doubt that Bernie would send up to the Hill legislation that really follows in the sort of the distinctions I made between the two of them. He would be talking for a financial transaction tax, for instance, which would provide funds for to eliminate any tuition fees at public colleges and universities. She would probably promote some kind of tax hike that would set up a program to do that for less affluent students. It's quite possible that if Bernie sends up to the Hill his universal bill, that it gets scaled back to what Hillary would send up. And it's possible that if Hillary sends up her bill, if she is president, it gets scaled back even more.
You're talking about universal health care?
Yeah, or universal health care. That's right. I mean, look, they have points of similarities. They're both opposed to the so-called Cadillac tax. I think if there were, I think if you're looking at things that are going on in the terms of medical costs right now, I would have to think there would be an upsurge for controlling drug prices, prescription drug prices. Given the level of publicity that's come out on just the ridiculous markups that the pharmaceutical companies inflict upon people who need medication, there would be similarities, and probably in areas like that. And mm-hmm. And Bernie would go for the whole enchilada, which is a universal publicly funded health insurance. Hillary would not go that far, but I would think a Democratic victory brings with it its own momentum. But again, there's the whole question of Congress, and you need a lot of momentum to turn Congress. So I have to say, the way the Republicans have been going on Capitol Hill, they may be creating more Democratic momentum than anyone had reasonably anticipated.
Yeah, it's quite a show over there, and I want to talk about Congress in a minute, but let's just stay a little bit more with the debates here. I want to get your take on comparing the Democrat and Republican debates, and I don't know if you saw the great post today on the Daily Kos, where they have a 5-year-old girl's view on the Democratic debate, and she said, "I like this debate show better than the other one because all the other people are all the people are less scary."
Yeah, well, that's true. Although there were moments I thought when, in very different ways, both Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee were pretty scary.
Right. Yeah, Jim Webb might have been at home.
Not doctrinally, just characterologically.
Right. I think Jim Webb could have been comfortable in the Republican debate there. But
I think Lincoln Chafee could have been comfortable on another planet. But anyway, that's...
Yeah. Well, it just seemed to me, and I obviously I'm a lifelong Democrat here, but it just seemed the Democrats were much more serious, much more fact-based. The Republicans are still denying climate change. Republicans, they all seem to want to have more war, as if our past 14-plus years isn't enough, but how would you characterize and compare the Democrat and Republican presidential debates?
Well, I mean, the Republican debate is a pretty legitimate reflection of what's going on in the Republican House right now. They have sort of soared away from any empirical fact and data. You feed a party a steady diet of Rush Limbaugh and Fox News, meaning you feed the rank and file as well as the elites for 25 years, and you get kind of an imperviousness to fact. I mean, the ism which the Republicans have the most trouble with is not communism, it's not socialism, it's empiricism. It's simply basing your positions on anything resembling facts. You know, I mean, again, the whole alleged immigrant crime wave, which is clearly non-existent, which the National Academy of Science released a study about 3-4 weeks ago pointing out that if anything, crime rates in among immigrants is about 1/4 that of people in similar socioeconomic conditions who are not immigrants. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just like they look at a photograph and see the negative image instead of the positive image, literally as well as metaphorically. So, I mean, there's just, you know, I mean, with people like Trump and Carson, nothing that they say bears any resemblance to any known actuality. So, I mean, there's that level of disconnect. And then, you know, so much of what goes on now that Trump has dominated the Republican field is sort of in the realm of, you know, almost personal abuse on the Republican side. There was clearly none of that on the Democratic side. And, you know, I mean, the moment in the Democratic debate that most helped Hillary and most helped Bernie was the same moment. It was when Bernie said, you know, people are sick and tired of your damn emails, you know, which, you know, basically reflected the ability to distinguish the serious issue from the media-made non-issue. And just sort of a sense of proportion as to what matters and what doesn't, or what matters most and what matters less, that, you know, simply doesn't exist on the Republican side of the fence, in which, you know, finally, you know, you get sort of more mainstream Republican commentators like David Brooks finally, you know, sort of in a recent column, almost repudiating where the Republican Party has ended up. So one can only hope that there will be more David Brooksy moments among Republicans who, you know, begin perhaps to look elsewhere for shreds of sanity.
Yeah, I think that was a great moment for both Bernie and Hillary, that, you know, when Hillary was saying, well, really, we shouldn't be talking about the emails, we should be talking about what matters to Americans, it seemed like a self-serving deflection. But when Bernie was given the chance to attack her on that issue, and he said, enough already with the damn email, it was just like, it seemed so genuine, and just, it's what we're all feeling, like, enough already, all of us Democrats.
Yeah, and the way he said it, too, I mean, it was a classic Bernie, you know, Brooklyn Street Yiddish inflected formulation that, again, goes to his authenticity credibility, which is off the scale. So, yes.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's interesting to see among the Republicans, some of the Republicans already dropping out, like Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, the great union buster, spent a ton of money and got nowhere, and he's already dropped out. We've got Jeb Bush, brother of W and son of George Herbert Walker Bush, was the front runner originally, and he's raised over $100 million, but he's, you know, lagging in single digits. So what do you see happening on the Republican side? You know, why is Jeb Bush doing so badly, and is there a credible Republican candidate that could really become the presidential nominee?
Yeah, I think there are a couple. I think the one who should give the Democrats the most pause and create the most apprehension is Marco Rubio, who certainly presents himself more like an actual sane person than much of the rest of the Republican field, is well-spoken, is young, is attractive, is Hispanic, although his flip-flop to an anti-immigrant position is not going to put him in good stead with most of the Latino electorate. So I think he's a possibility. You know, I get the feeling too, the way that Ted Cruz has sort of been refusing at any point to criticize Donald Trump, no matter what Trump does, and to basically back him up, that Cruz is sort of counting on if and when Trump flames out, he will be the one sort of recognizable political figure who tries to take the nativist far right, far right, they're all far right, but the far right, forces in the Republican Party. I mean, Cruz is so extreme and has spent so much political capital on attacking his own party leaders, which plays well with the Republican base, but I really don't see him being able to win were he to be the nominee in November. I can't envision him actually winning. I think Rubio and Ohio Governor John Kasich would be the strongest for a couple of reasons, including that they come from absolutely crucial swing states, Florida and Ohio, respectively. So they would be the strongest. That doesn't mean they're going to get the nomination. Kasich, in particular, is anathema to much of the Republican base because he accepted the Medicaid expansion that was offered to the states as part of Obamacare, which, you know, renders him a heretic as far as most Republican primary voters are concerned.
Yes, I think that's a great assessment. Let's talk now about the U.S. House of Representatives. This is just such, you know, it just seems like a real clown show over there. And it's not, you know, it would be funny if it weren't so scary, but we've got John Boehner sent shockwaves when he announced that he's going to resign as Speaker of the House, planning to leave in October. But the Republicans are having trouble finding someone to take his place as Speaker. So what do you see happening there? Why is Boehner resigning? Why is it so hard to find a replacement as Speaker?
Well, they're not a House divided against themselves. They're a House caucus divided against themselves. And in either case, as Lincoln said, it really cannot stand. They have a hard core of 40 and probably a soft core or a hard core plus a periphery of more than that, that really seems to view their function as just throwing a monkey wrench into the daily workings of government, and that's all they need to do. So, you know, I mean, it's very hard if the leadership actually just wants to, you know, in a metaphoric sense, keep the trains running or keep the country from defaulting on the national debt or what have you. Mm-hmm. Even to do that, and to be a leader in either the House or the Senate, as Mitch McConnell would attest in the Senate as a Republican Senate Majority Leader, is to put yourself under an attack from your own ranks, that you're not throwing a monkey wrench into everything, and so you had for a variety of reasons Kevin McCarthy, the Majority Leader, pulling out at the last minute from the speakership election. You have the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, Paul Ryan, whom Republican establishment and some conservatives think is the only, you know, remaining grown-up, and that sets a low bar for what a grown-up is, only, you know, grown-up who could take the speakership, but he's clearly been resisting this. And then you have, you know, I mean, it's hard to describe, you know, these far-right entrepreneurs, a guy named Walker from Florida who was Speaker of the Florida House briefly. There's even one Republican freshman from Montana who said he's interested, you know, and he's been in Congress now for 10 months in being Speaker. I mean, you know, it's really just, you know, an amazing spectacle. In a certain sense, it's following the trajectory of some revolutions, and we're now kind of in the, you know, you know, Marat and Danton and the French Revolution eventually killed for not being radical enough. We're sort of in the Robespierre period, right now. I mean, the Committee of Public Safety is just threatening just about everybody except themselves with the guillotine. And I mean, there's really, I have no way of handicapping what's going to happen there. Now, I mean, there's a question of, you know, is this going to hurt the Republicans a year from now at the polls? I don't know. It depends. You can really, you know, can imagine, you know, at the most, say, a totally self-destructive cycle in which the Republicans don't extend the national debt, and, you know, eventually the government stops paying Social Security checks, the disproportionate number of recipients of which are elderly Republicans, old white Republicans. They would not let it go that far because that's their base. But, you know, I mean, the how much mischief they can wreak and how much it will hurt them. The House is, of course, protected, House Republicans are, by having essentially gerrymandered their own districts. So it would take a huge wave to dislodge them from the House. Senate, on the other hand, has a lot of seats in play, more Republican seats in play than Democratic seats in play. I think there's a pretty good chance the Democrats can take back the Senate. But as we know, it takes 60 votes to do anything serious in the Senate, and I don't think the Democrats or the Republicans are going to come out of the next election with 60 Senate votes. So, you know, remains to be seen. And clearly the need for a huge legion of Bernieites and others transform the Congress and to win back some state legislatures so that the next redistricting after the 2020 census isn't so Republican friendly, all of that will be required.
Right. And it's a good description of it as an amazing spectacle. I'm wondering what's going to happen with all this disorganization and chaos within the Republicans in the House. What's going to happen when, in a few weeks, we reach the limit for the government borrowing to pay our bills, and they're going to have to vote to lift the debt ceiling limit? Will they even be able to function at that point? Or
I think there have been some reports that John Boehner is staying around to push that through. And you know, he will have to violate, I presume, the so-called Hastert rule. And it's not been a great day for Denny Hastert either. If people have been following the news, it appears he's pled guilty to a bank fraud and paying off someone who accused him of molesting some folks back when he was a wrestling coach. But anyway, the Hastert rule, which said you don't go to the floor unless you have a majority of the Republican caucus. I think Boehner will probably try to push through raising the debt ceiling, even if he has a minority of Republicans plus Democrats doing it. I mean, that's really the only strategic reason for hanging around. Although, you know, I have this image of Boehner in which the Republicans can never get it together to elect a successor, and he's stuck here. It's kind of like a comic reverse version of King Lear, where, you know, the king abdicates and everything falls apart, and in this case the king tries to abdicate, everything falls apart, and he can't leave. So we shall see. We shall see where it goes. But I'm pretty sure Boehner will try to get the debt ceiling through, even if he doesn't have majority Republican support.
Yeah.
But I've been wrong before.
Well, you know, that Hastert rule, is that really a rule, or is that just kind of a rule of thumb? But
It's not a rule of the House. It's just something that the House Republican caucus. Boehner has violated it in the past in certain particular instances, and I think he would do it again. The complicating factor, though, is this. You will have all of these people running to succeed him in the Republican caucus all of whom will be pressured not to, you know, to come out against raising the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, numerically, if Boehner gets just, you know, like 40 Republican votes out of the 200 and whatever it is, 240 who are in the House, he only needs about 40 to pass it, because he'll get all the Democratic votes as well. So I think that's the course he will take. But, you know, it's even going to poison the chalice, as it were, even more for the party, because I think all of his successors will probably say that's the last time we'll do this. You know, this will not happen if I'm going to be the speaker. And then we'll be stuck with that. So who knows?
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. You know, what I don't understand is why some of the Republicans don't look about exactly that kind of an alliance with the Democrats. Like, if you could get enough Republicans to vote for you and get the Democrats to vote for you for Speaker, you could win the speakership. Now, you may not have...
But the Democrats are not going to vote for a Republican for Speaker. I mean, you know, that would put them... First of all, because even the most moderate so-called Republican in the House, given the ideological polarization, is way to the right of any of the rightmost Democrat in the House. Mm-hmm. We're long past the time when there were Southern Democrats who were as or more conservative than, let's say, Northern Republicans. Secondly, the very fact that so many Republicans are in gerrymandered districts means that they are more fearful of a primary challenger to their right than they are of a Democrat in the general election. So, I mean, the whole system of rewards, incentives, and punishments by voters, once you've carved the district lines that way, pushes the vast majority of House Republicans even more to the right than they might otherwise would be just left to their own devices. So, I think it's hard to envision very many Republicans supporting that. They would immediately think they'd be challenged and lose in the next primary election. And, you know, the Democrats, you know, if the choice is having someone with Boehner's politics supported by the Democrats, or, you know, or having Nancy Pelosi after 2016, I mean, they're going to stick, you know, voting for Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to check in with you on two major issues that have come up since you were last on the show. What's happening now with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the new trade agreement, which a lot of people were concerned about in terms of, you know, more benefits, both in terms of money and power for the international corporations, and they kind of succeeded in getting it through in Congress, but there's more negotiations happening. Can you give us an update? Where does the TPP stand now, and is there any hope of stopping it?
I think there is. It's always been in trouble from two separate and opposed directions. One from Democrats who are concerned about the whole idea of essentially carving out special rules for corporations in harmonizing national standards and not really harmonizing them up for workers or the environment very much. So that's one source of concern. A second, you know, in two ways. The Republicans who had been generally support free trade really don't, you know, hate Obama's guts and don't want to vote for anything he supports. So there's significant Republican opposition, and it has expressed itself in a number of ways. First of all, just, you know, the flat out, if Obama's for it, I'm against it. But interestingly, on the whole question of how long American pharmaceutical companies could hold exclusive patents on certain categories of drugs that are badly needed in the developing nations that can't really afford to pay market rates for them. Many of these nations do not themselves have that kind of patent exclusivity. So they came in and said, we don't want that. In the United States, it had been set at 12 years, a figure that reflects the lobbying and campaign finance power of the major pharmaceutical companies. And they arrived at a compromise at the, in the TPP of 5 years. Well, a lot of progressive Democrats, the Sherrod Browns and Elizabeth Warrens and Bernie Sanders, say, no, we shouldn't, you know, enable these country, enable these companies to bilk, you know, these third world countries, and probably cause a significant number of illnesses and deaths, by having this, exclusivity. And then you have defenders of the pharmaceutical industry in the Republican Party, like, Orrin Hatch, for instance, senator from Utah, saying, oh, God, it's terrible that they reduce the standard from 12 years to 5. That's not giving enough, they say, protection. They mean profit, really, to the pharmaceutical companies. So, I mean, there's opposition coming at the TPP from both sides, and I would say it's no better than 50-50 as to whether it will pass. Now, it doesn't require 60 votes in the Senate. It only requires 51. But, you know, I think most House Republicans will be against it. Many Senate Republicans will be against it. And a majority of Democrats, and certainly in the House, and overwhelming majority in the House, and a number, but I don't know what that number is. It won't be as overwhelming by any means in the Senate. Will oppose it. So it's completely up in the air at the moment.
Okay, great. Well, we'll have you back to talk about that when that fight is on the floor. That's all the time we have for today. Harold Marson, thank you so very much for being with us today and for your interesting and entertaining political analysis.
Thank you, Eleanor. It's always good to be here.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.